Not all monsters are myths.
Michigan Monsters.
This is Michigan Monsters. A true crime gothic.
Hey there. Welcome to Michigan, where the lakes are salt-free, the monsters are human, and the moms are unhinged, apparently. I'm Jen Carpenter, and today we're going to be talking about how Michigan could never have its own mom talk show because they'd have to film it in a damn prison. Tell me if you guys have noticed this, or if it's just me and the way that I am like hyper aware of true crime cases involving Michigan, but there has been a startling trend recently of Netflix documentaries based on batshit crazy moms from Michigan. We talked about one such documentary a couple seasons ago, Girl in the Picture, about the Suzanne Savakis case. Quick recap on that, as it was quite a while ago now, but in 1990, a young mother was the victim of a fatal hit and run. The only suspect was her much older husband. When authorities began to investigate, they found that the man, Franklin Delano Floyd, was actually Suzanne's dad, her stepfather, to be exact. He was married to Suzanne's mother, Sandra Brandenburg, for a short time in the 70s. Sandra was from Michigan. She lived in the Livonia area. That's where she had her kids. But then she kind of took off across the country with her children when her relationship with their father fell apart. When Suzanne, her eldest daughter, was six, her mother went to jail for 30 days for writing a bad check. And when she returned home, her house was empty. Her new husband and all four of her children were gone. The three youngest were later found in the care of adoption agencies, but the eldest daughter, Suzanne, was just gone. Her stepfather had taken her across the country. He raised her as his daughter. And then when she was old enough, he married her. The true horror of what happened to Suzanne took years to come to light. And when it did, Suzanne's mother had some hard questions to answer. Mainly, what the fuck? Police had no record of her ever reporting her daughter missing, and the child's biological father and other family members had no idea that Suzanne had disappeared either. According to Sandra, she did try to report the kidnapping to police when it happened, but they told her that as Suzanne's stepfather, Floyd had the right to take her wherever he wanted. But authorities maintained that that wasn't true. Suzanne never even reported the kidnapping. While Floyd, for his part, insisted that Sandra, his wife of like 6 months or something ridiculous like that, sold Suzanne to him. She didn't want to be a mother. She couldn't support her children. She was always trying to find ways to offload them. So when he offered to give her money to let him take Suzanne with him, she said yes. That's his story. Either way, mom of the year over here, right? Sandra Brandenburg of Livonia, at best, didn't look for her six-year-old daughter when she was kidnapped. At worst, she sold her to the man who went on to subject the girl to a lifetime of unspeakable abuse before eventually killing her. I left out a lot, obviously, because I already did a whole episode on this. It was episode 92, Photograph, to be exact, if you want to go back and listen. But that's the gist of it. Girl in the Picture was directed by Sky Borgman and released on Netflix in 2022. And just a few years later, another Michigan mother was highlighted in a Netflix doc directed by Sky Borgman. You've seen it. I've seen it. And we're all still so pissed about this one. This documentary is called Unknown Caller, The High School Catfish. And girl, half of the reason I brought the podcast back was so that we could talk about this, if I'm being honest. Now, if somehow you have not seen this one yet, pause this episode and go watch it. It's just a single episode documentary. It's not a whole series. It's like an hour and a half long. Doesn't take very long to get through. Trust me, you will be sat and shocked, rattled to your core. Okay, go watch it. Everybody back? Ready to take a road trip to Waterford with me? Because that is where Kendra Licari lives now. It's not that far. I will rent a bus. I'm kidding. Everything else we talk about here is going to be a spoiler. So if you did not go watch Unknown Caller in that little pause that I gave you and you hadn't already seen it, anything that gets ruined for you here is your own fault. I do want to point out real quick the irony of the title alone. Unknown Caller, the High School Catfish. The term catfish to describe someone who creates a fake online persona to fool others, usually but not always related to dating, originates obviously from the show Catfish on MTV. You remember Neve and Max, and then Neve and a bunch of randos, and then Neve and Cammy, and now the show's canceled, right? I think. But the show came as a result of a documentary by the same name that was released in 2010 about Neve's own experience with a catfish. And the term catfish came from something that the husband of Neve's online stalker said. And he did it, if I'm remembering this correctly, it's been, what, like 15 years now? But I feel like he said it in a southern accent, and they were in Michigan, and they always, I don't know why they do that, that's so embarrassing. But this is what he said. They used to tank cod from Alaska all the way to China. They'd keep them in vats in the ship. By the time the codfish reached China, the flesh was mush and tasteless. So this guy came up with the idea that if you put the cod in these big vats, put some catfish in with them, and the catfish will keep the cod agile. And there are those people who are catfish in life, and they keep you on your toes. They keep you guessing. They keep you thinking. They keep you fresh. And I thank God for the catfish, because we would be droll, boring, and dull if we didn't have somebody nipping at our fin. That's deep, and I don't think, if I'm being honest, I don't think that this man came up with that quote, but it was good cinema either way. And the woman that was featured in the original documentary, this man's wife, Neve Stalker, the reason that we use the term catfish the way we do now, she's from Michigan. Yeah, if you guys didn't know, the literal OG catfish is from Michigan, the very first one. The UP even. If I remember correctly, the woman that Neve thought he was talking to was in one city in the UP, and he found his catfish in like a nearby city, but all of this happened in the Upper Peninsula. All of that to say, Michigan is ground zero for catfishing, unfortunately. So it makes sense that this crazy fucking documentary takes place in Michigan. Beale City, to be exact, which is about 80 miles due north of Lansing. And the documentary itself filmed about 20 minutes from my house. The high school scenes were actually filmed at St. John's Middle School. So like when we say close to home, this one is close to home. Kendra Licari of Waterford, which is only about 20 miles from Livonia, which is where shitty mom number one from today is from, subjected her teenage daughter to a lifetime of trauma when she relentlessly stalked and cyberbullied her, going so far as telling her own daughter, her own fucking daughter, repeatedly to kill herself in a possible case of Munchausen by internet, which I didn't even know was like a thing. I was watching this with my kids and we were all, again, just sat and shocked. And I knew how it was going to end. I remember this happening real time because it was so close to home for me. So I knew where it was going, and I was still somehow shocked by the things that were being said and the things that happened. And at one point, I paused it and I said, this is almost like Munchausen by proxy, except with the internet. And not like 5 minutes later, the detective called it Munchausen's by internet, which I had never heard of before, but is apparently a thing, and this bitch has it for sure. Unknown Caller was directed by Sky Borgman and released on Netflix in 2025. Again, short synopsis. This one, I just can't, other than to say fuck that bitch, really and truly. But if you have not seen Unknown Caller, you have to go watch it. It's just, you have to. It's worth the Netflix subscription if you don't have one, and then just, you know, cancel it in a couple days or something. Watch Bridgerton first, too. That's a good one. Anyway, neither of these Sky Borgman-directed Netflix specials, both of which went viral, are the one that we are focusing on today, because there's just so many, I can't cover them all. Listen, I don't know if we need to, like, stay out of the Great Lakes, or if we need to stop drinking the tap water, or if we need to stop playing in the rain puddles as kids, but there has got to be something in the water around here, because this shit's crazy. The third, not the first, not the second, the third recent Netflix documentary about a fucked up mother from Michigan that we're going to talk about today is Into the Fire, about the disappearance of Andrea Bowman from Hamilton, Michigan in 1989. Kathy Trakanian did not have an easy life growing up. Her mother, Shirley, had six children with three different men and eventually married an active duty soldier, which meant that the blended family moved often, seven times before Kathy started seventh grade. Her stepfather was always gone, and her mother, who was physically and emotionally abusive, was overwhelmed taking care of half a dozen children, one of whom had special needs. No one had any time for Kathy, and she was left to her own devices when she wasn't expected to play second mother to her younger siblings. When Kathy was 10, she was molested by a family friend, the husband of one of her mom's friends. When she was 12, she was raped by an older teenager, and when she was 14, she decided she just couldn't take it anymore. She fled her home in Virginia with nothing but the clothes on her back and no plan. She just had to get out. She hitchhiked to Tennessee, and she wound up at the Greyhound Station in Memphis. There, she ran into some folks just coming back from Mardi Gras. They were, you know, wearing the colored beads and talking excitedly about how they'd experienced all these really cool things in the Big Easy, and it sounded so magical to Kathy, so that was where she went. There was a well-established underground community of runaway teens in New Orleans in the 70s. The kids found each other places to stay, helped each other find jobs, and just kind of helped each other survive on their own. Through this group, Kathy met a boy named Randy Badger. Randy was 19, and he had just hitchhiked from Los Angeles to Louisiana. The two fell in love, never mind that she was 14 and he was 19, but it was the 70s, I guess, right? They fell in love, and they were soon attached at the hip, doing everything together, including a brief stint as circus sideshow workers. So, literally everything, things you wouldn't even think. They moved in together and they began living as a married couple, even though, again, Kathy was only 14. In South Carolina, it was legal for 14-year-olds to get married with parental consent. So 14-year-old Kathy and 19-year-old Randy made the trip from New Orleans armed with the necessary paperwork signed by Kathy's parents. Her mother, when they asked her about this, actually encouraged the union. She wanted someone else to be responsible for her daughter. So at the age of 14, Kathy became a married woman? Less than a year later, she was pregnant. On June 23, 1974, 16-year-old Kathy Badger gave birth to a daughter, Alexis Miranda Badger. Kathy wanted to provide her daughter with the best life possible and did her best to balance work and motherhood, while 21-year-old Randy was more concerned with partying and hooking up with other women. One day, when Alexis was a few months old, Kathy returned from work to find Randy making out with another woman in the living room, while baby Alexis screamed her head off from the back bedroom where her father had stashed her, not even wearing a diaper. This was not the life that Kathy had run away from home for, and it wasn't the life she wanted for her daughter. In her mind, she had only one option: to go back home, where at least she'd have support from family. So just before Alexis's first Christmas, she and her teenage mother boarded a Greyhound for a 5-day trek from New Orleans back to Virginia. But support is not what they found when they arrived back in Norfolk. I know I don't say that right. I'm so sorry. I don't know how to say it. Kathy's mother had recently been diagnosed with breast cancer, and she was given just a few years to live. She needed Kathy there to take care of her younger siblings. There was no room in that house, in that life, for a baby. Still, Kathy did her best to raise her daughter in this new, chaotic, and sometimes hostile environment. Alexis made it easy, though. She was a beautiful baby, if not completely bald-headed, which Kathy made a point to say in the documentary. She was well-behaved, she never cried, she was just a sweet, sweet little girl that Kathy was learning and growing right beside. But the entire time, she had her own mother in her ear telling her that she wasn't good enough, that she wouldn't be able to give Alexis the life that she deserved, that she should give her up for adoption. And I think that we all, as moms, right, feel like we're not good enough for our kids, especially when they're young, and especially when we're young and we don't know what we're doing. I was a teenage mom. I wasn't 16. I was 18, but I was still super fucking young. I wasn't ready for parenthood in any way. I was not in a healthy relationship. But I had the support of my family. I did have the support of my son's father, as toxic as that relationship was. He was still in the picture. And I had the support of his family. And it was still hard as shit. Kathy, though, she really only had her mother, who was not great. So to have the one person that makes up your support system telling you you can't do this over and over and over, eventually that's going to wear you down. And it did. As Alexis's first birthday approached, Kathy's mom really stoked the coals of the guilt train. She even got a Catholic adoption agency involved, and together they pressured Kathy to relinquish her rights to her 9-month-old daughter. It was a lot of, she's getting older, Kathy. It's just going to get harder, Kathy. She needs to learn how to potty train and behave and get ready for school. She's going to need supplies and clothes, and you can barely afford formula. Just a lot of that kind of stuff. The way her mother framed it, it wasn't a matter of if Kathy would have to give her daughter up, but when. And the longer she waited, the harder it would be to find her a good home. Adoptive parents wanted babies, and Alexis wouldn't be a baby much longer. So, because Kathy loved her little girl so much and wanted the absolute best for her, she agreed to give Alexis up for adoption, even though it broke her heart. She was promised by the agency that since Alexis was still a baby, let's be real here, since she was a little white baby especially, she was going to be the number one draft pick at the orphanage, right? She was going to go to the absolute best home. The adoption was a closed adoption, so the assurance of a bright future was all Kathy really got. She didn't get any actual information on Alexis's adoptive parents at all. Heartbroken, Kathy was determined to make something of herself so that if Alexis ever came looking for her, and she hoped that someday she would have a life that her daughter could be proud of. But she knew she had to leave home again to do it, and so she did. Over the years, she fought against her guilt and thoughts of suicide and eventually found happiness, or at least a version of it. In 1991, when Kathy was 33 and her long-lost daughter was 16, Kathy was working as a nurse back in New Orleans again, where she met and fell in love with Ed Turkanian. Their courtship was a whirlwind. They left New Orleans together and returned to Virginia just long enough to get married, after like 10 weeks of dating, I think it said. And then they moved to Massachusetts and began to build a life together there. About a month into their marriage, Kathy told Ed about Alexis. Kathy Turkanian never had other children, Her experiences as both a mother and a daughter had been so traumatic, she wanted to break that cycle. After Alexis's 18th birthday passed in 1992, Kathy hoped that someday there might be a knock on her door, a letter in the mail, or a phone call from an unknown number that would reunite her with her daughter. This is definitely one of those be careful what you wish for scenarios, because she did eventually get a letter from a social worker about Alexis, and that letter would upend her entire life. Before we talk about the letter, I need to tell you a little bit about a man named Carl Koppelman. Carl is like the OG armchair detective. In 2009, 46-year-old Carl left his career as an accountant to become his mother's full-time caregiver as her health began to decline. In his downtime, Carl developed a new hobby. He started perusing the depths of the website Web Sleuths and the Namus database and reading about cold cases, missing persons, and John and Jane Doe cases. And he realized that he had a very particular set of skills that these databases desperately needed. What kind of skills? Spreadsheet making skills, of course. He created this, like, cross-reference database by region to match up missing persons cases with unsolved John and Jane Doe cases. Statistically, there had to be some answers there, right? Like, we've got all these people that just disappeared and all these bodies that we found that we don't know who they are. There has to be some crossover. And there was. Over the years, Carl has helped to solve, I believe the last number I saw in this article was several years old, was close to a dozen cold cases through his meticulous research and his forensic sketches of victims, all of which he does, by the way, on a volunteer basis. One of the first cases that piqued his interest was that of the Racine County Jane Doe. On July 21st, 1999, the body of a young woman was found near the edge of a cornfield in Racine, Wisconsin. She'd been dead less than 24 hours, but heavy rains had washed away much of the physical evidence. Authorities were able to determine that the woman was likely in her 20s, 5'8", 120 pounds, with reddish-brown hair and hazel eyes. The woman had broken bones, both old and new, and showed signs of sexual assault, as well as evidence of long-term abuse. When Carl cross-referenced this woman's age, her description, and her location with missing persons cases from that same area and time frame, several possible matches popped up. After comparing the cases more closely, only one remained. In 1989, a 14-year-old girl had disappeared from the small town of Hamilton, Michigan, which is just across Lake Michigan from Racine, Wisconsin, almost a straight shot right across the lake, which obviously Lake Michigan is huge, but still. If that girl was still alive 10 years later in 1999 when the Racine County Jane Doe was found, she would have been in her mid-20s, and the physical description fit as well. So age, place, description, all a match. The missing girl had been adopted, though, so the only way to go in now and test her DNA against that of the Racine County Jane Doe was to find her birth mother. Now, back to that letter. In April of 2010, when she was in her early 50s, Kathy Cherkanian received a letter from a social worker. When she saw the return address, she was hopeful that her dream of reconnecting with her beloved Alexis, who would now be in her mid-30s, was about to come true. Instead, she found herself facing the worst nightmare imaginable. The letter explained that Kathy's daughter had disappeared from her adoptive parents' rural Michigan home in 1989 when she was 14 years old. Authorities were investigating a Jane Doe case out of Wisconsin, and they had reason to believe that the young woman, who was killed more than a decade after Alexis disappeared, and Kathy's missing daughter, might be one and the same. For 35 years, Kathy Cherkanian had been telling herself that the agony she endured over giving up her daughter was worth it, that Alexis was better off, happy, healthy, thriving, living an amazing life. But none of that was true. The realization hit her like a tidal wave of grief. Kathy agreed, of course, to give the DNA sample, but she needed more information. Her daughter had been missing for over 20 years, and she was just now finding out? What were the circumstances? What sort of investigation was done? Was she kidnapped? A runaway? Kathy remembered what horrors had driven her to run away when she was 14. What could have happened to her sweet girl to make her disappear at, ironically, the exact same age? But the letter she received had none of that information. It didn't even include her daughter's adopted name. And when Kathy inquired with the social worker, she was met with a brick wall of privacy. She'd agreed to a closed adoption, after all. I don't know about you guys, but if I found out that my child, who I loved and thought about every day, who I raised for almost an entire year before I was forced to give her up, who I was promised would be better off and was out there living her best life somewhere, if I found out that she had been missing for over 2 decades and I was just now finding out because you need my help figuring out if you found her body, and then you still wouldn't tell me anything about her, including her name, I would burn it all down. I would burn it all the fuck down. And that is exactly what Kathy Cherkanian did. Kathy knew 3 things. She knew Alexis's date of birth, obviously. She now knew that she lived in Michigan, and she knew that she went missing in 1989. So not much, but that was enough, because 10 minutes into her Google search, she found her. Just like that. Alexis Miranda Badger had become Andrea Michelle Bowman. And Andrea Michelle Bowman had seemingly disappeared into thin air on March 11th, 1989. Brenda Engweiler grew up in Muskegon, Michigan, not far from the shores of Lake Michigan on the state's west side. In high school, she met Dennis Bowman, a boy a couple years older than her, and fell in love. He was her first, and as it would turn out, only boyfriend. After high school, Dennis enlisted in the Navy. In 1969, the same year Brenda graduated, she and Dennis got engaged. In 1971, right around the time that 14-year-old Kathy was running away from home, Brenda, 20, and Dennis, 22, got married. Dennis was still in the Navy and was stationed out in California at the time. After the wedding, Brenda moved out to the West Coast to join him. By 1974, the Bowmans, now in their mid-20s, were stationed in Norfolk, Virginia. I'm just going to say it worse every time. I'm sorry. Stationed in Virginia, the same town that Kathy had just returned to as a single teenage mother with a baby. The Bowmans desperately wanted a baby of their own, but after a series of tests, they were told they were very unlikely to conceive. As such, they were pursuing adoption. At the exact same time that 17-year-old Kathy was being pressured to give her baby up. The Bowmans got a call about a 10-month-old baby that needed placement, and they jumped at the chance to become parents. They began the adoption process and changed their new daughter's name from Alexis Miranda Badger to Andrea Michelle Bowman. I think it's a little weird that they kept her exact initials, like the B from Badger to Bowman, that's by chance, but AMB, AMB, they kept her initial. That's weird to me, but whatever. Maybe just a coincidence. Soon after the adoption was complete, Dennis went from active duty to reserves, and he and Brenda moved back to Michigan with their new daughter to a tiny town of about 3,600 people called Hamilton, which is just south of Holland, which is, of course, known for its tulips and for that creepy-ass horror movie that came out last year. I think it's just called Holland. Holland or Holland, Michigan? One of those two. Hamilton, as it would happen, is just under 100 miles, or about an hour and a half drive, west of Lansing. How do I know that? Because I Googled it, bitch. I was watching that documentary, and I was like, where is Brenda at right now? And I Googled it. So, the more you know, I guess. Speaking of the documentary real quick, that's the reason we're here. They did Hamilton so dirty. You know how they do, like, when they're doing a documentary and they do that, like, shots of the town where they're saying, like, it's a small town where everybody knows everybody. Well, they did that. They did, like, the overhead flyby of the treetops and the rooftops. But the first close-up shot they did was of litter. Just, like, random trash on the side of the road as they're talking about Hamilton's population. So, yeah, Hamilton is, in fact, one of those towns where everybody knows everybody, where there's one school, one gas station, one grocery store, and a whole lot of churches. Everybody in Hamilton went to church. You were viewed as an outcast if you didn't. It was weird. Brenda and Dennis Bowman were even Sunday school teachers. They worked different places around town, him usually in some sort of blue-collar job, her doing all kinds of random shit. I think I read somewhere that she worked at the jewelry counter at Myers for a little while. Yes, that is Myers with an S. Andrea went to school, made friends. They just lived a quiet, peaceful, wholesome family life. Except for that time in 1980. When Andrea was six, that Dennis went to prison for 5 years for attempting to abduct and rape a teenager, and Brenda, being the devoted wife she was, uprooted her daughter's entire life to move to the Upper Peninsula to be near Dennis as he served out his sentence at Kinross Correctional Facility, then complained about Andrea being a brat and having a chip on her shoulder over having to leave her entire life behind and spend her Saturdays visiting her pedophile father in prison. There is an actual audio clip in the documentary where Brenda says, and I quote, "Heaven forbid I take that child into a prison visiting room." Like, bitch, what? You should be taking a child into a prison visiting room when the reason her father's in prison is because he tried to fucking rape a teenager. You bitch. Sorry, this one has me so heated, guys. On May 23rd, 1980, a 19-year-old girl was riding her bike on a sunny afternoon near Kirk Park in Holland when a man on a motorcycle ran her off the road. He told her to get off her bike and walk into the woods. She stood there, frozen, trying to decide what to do. Going to the second location with this angry-looking 30-something white dude was not the move, and she knew that, but she didn't know what to do. So as she and the man stood there staring at one another, he pulled out a pistol and shot in her general direction, again telling her to walk into the woods. When she still didn't move, he fired a second shot, this time near her feet, and he told her, once again, to go into the woods, and if she didn't, the third shot was gonna hit her. At that moment, a truck drove by, and the young woman flagged them down for help. The man took off in the other direction, but police were called, a description was given, and 31-year-old Dennis Lee Bowman was picked up a short time later. When police arrested him on suspicion of attempted murder, he said, "You gotta let me go. I have to go pick up my daughter from school." They did not, in fact, let him go. They instead convicted him of assault with intent to commit criminal sexual conduct and sentenced him to 5 to 10 years in prison. He was sent to the UP. Brenda moved to the UP to be close to her pedophile husband, and poor little Andrea, who'd been essentially stolen from her real mother for the promise of a better life, was dragged along for the ride. While in custody, Dennis underwent treatment by a psychologist who determined that Dennis would pose a threat to women if he were ever to be released. Ever to be released is wild phrasing considering that he wasn't even serving a life sentence. He was serving 5 to 10 years and only wound up serving just over 5. He was released on January 31st, 1986, and he moved back to Hamilton with his idiot accomplice of a wife and his 11-year-old adopted daughter. Just over 3 years later, Andrea would disappear. In interviews with authorities about Andrea, Dennis said something to the effect of, "She was a good kid, and then when she turned 12, 13, a switch just flipped." Gee, Professor Petto, I wonder why that could be. There was a lot of change in the Bowman house after Dennis got out of prison. Brenda got pregnant expeditiously, something doctors told her would never happen. And she and Dennis had a little redheaded baby girl they named Vanessa, 13 years Andrea's junior. Now, Andrea was not jealous. She loved her baby sister. She doted on her, took care of her after school and on the weekends, and acted almost as a second mother. She even seemed afraid, friends said, to leave baby Vanessa home alone with her parents, and she was anxious when she was away from her sister for too long. Also, coincidentally, right around the time that the Bowmans became a family of four, Dennis and Brenda revealed to Andrea that she was adopted. According to the Bowmans, this was the cause of Andrea's sudden change in behavior. They said she became unruly, defiant, violent even. She had trouble in school, stole, broke things, started doing drugs, skipping school, running away. They were just trying to do the best they could by their troubled daughter, but they were at a loss. Andrea's friends told a very different story. They described her as a typical teenager, for the most part, who was very obviously trying to hide a troubled home life. She tried, almost too hard, to fit in and make friends. She wasn't a very good student, per se, but she wasn't failing. She talked back to teachers here and there, but all the kids did. She was funny, and she was thoughtful, and she loved her little sister. Once she knew she was adopted, Andrea started going by her real name, Alexis, or sometimes Alex, and she would often talk about how she was going to run away and go find her real mom. Just as Kathy had felt the pull to leave her dysfunctional home when she was 14, Alexis seemed to be heading down the same path. Alexis, and we're going to call her Alexis from here on out because we've reached the point in the story where she knows that's her real name and that's what she wanted people to call her. Alexis didn't often have friends over, but when she did, it wasn't unusual for them to witness Dennis's abuse firsthand. A slap across the face at the dinner table, chasing her up the stairs to her room for taking too long to get home from school and doing God knows what once he had her alone in her bedroom. But it was much worse than that. In 1988, Alexis started her freshman year at Hamilton High School and joined the band. One late fall afternoon after band practice, she went home with a friend after school. When it was time for her to go home, Alexis went into a full-blown panic attack, begging to stay. She confided in her friend and her friend's mother that her father had been sexually abusing her and that her mother knew about it and didn't care. The friend's mother allowed her to stay the night and the next morning took her directly to the principal's office. Alexis repeated the story to school officials and police were called. So were Alexis's parents. And in a small room seated just feet away from her abusers with multiple law enforcement and school officials staring at her, Alexis was asked to go into detail about how, when, where her own father was sexually abusing her. When she couldn't slash wouldn't do this, her story fell apart, and authorities determined through their investigation that the allegations were false. Brenda called Alexis a liar. Dennis said Alexis was lashing out because she was angry about finding out she was adopted. This, police believed, and they sent Alexis home with her parents that day. A few months later, she was gone. March 11th, 1989 was a Saturday. According to Dennis, he drove 14-year-old Alexis to the school for a band thing, then picked her up when it was over. On the way home, she was quiet and withdrawn. Upon arriving home, she went straight to her room to do homework. Brenda was working second shift that day at a place she called Lincolnshire, which, according to the Google, looks like it might be like a party store in a deli in Holland, if that's the same place, maybe, which tracks because Brenda has worked a lot of cashier jobs. Dennis had to drive her to work that evening, and they decided to take baby Vanessa, who was just over a year old, with them so that Alexis could focus on her homework. Dennis arrived back home to find the front door unlocked, the door to the master bedroom busted open, and his teenage daughter gone. He called police, not so much to report Alexis missing, but to report that she had stolen from the house before she left. He told them that there was $150 in cash missing from his nightstand and a go bag missing from his room. Apparently, the Bowmans all had go bags. Bags packed with essentials ready to go in case they needed to take off in a hurry, because all normal families have those, right? That's suspicious. That's weird. Despite the fact that Dennis Bowman was still on parole for attempting to kidnap a teenage girl to rape her, and despite the fact that his own teenage daughter had accused him of sexually abusing her just a few months earlier, police simply took Dennis Bowman at his word. Alexis was a troubled teen who'd run away from home. Case closed. Except for the part where she stole the cash. That was a crime. An arrest warrant was issued for Alexis for larceny, with Dennis Bowman listed as her victim. Following Alexis's disappearance, the Bowmans talked the right talk, but they failed to walk the right walk, and people noticed. They claimed to be worried about their missing daughter, but one of the first things they did after she took off was move. They left their farmhouse on the corner of 52nd and Lincoln and bought a small plot of land nearby on 136th Avenue that they put a manufactured home on. Neighbors thought it was strange that they would leave the house Alexis knew as home. What if she came back? How would she find them? Brenda told stories about how every night after work, she'd drive around town searching for Alexis, sometimes using someone else's vehicle so that Alexis wouldn't recognize her and run. She called police occasionally to report that Alexis had been spotted at the mall, a truck stop, Myers, how she'd cut and dyed her hair or was strung out on drugs, working as a stripper, working as a sex worker at a truck stop, was pregnant, etc. Alexis's friends hoped that she'd gone off and found her birth mother and was living happily ever after, far from the Bowmans. Time marched on, and the town of Hamilton forgot about Andrea Bowman. Until armchair detective Carl Koppelman suggested a possible link between the Racine County Jane Doe and Andrea Bowman cases, prompting a social worker to reach out to Kathy Turkanian for a DNA sample. Even though all she knew was her daughter's birth date, that she'd lived in Michigan, and that she'd disappeared in 1989, that was enough for Kathy to find her baby after decades of wondering what happened to her. She was the only one who'd been wondering that, it seemed. Once she found her daughter's name and the name of her daughter's adoptive parents, she got to work doing what no one else ever had: looking for Alexis. She started a Facebook group called Find Andrea M. Bowman, hoping to connect with people who'd known her daughter. Soon, she began hearing from old friends of Alexis's about how Alexis was being abused at home, possibly even sexually abused, how she had started going by her birth name and talked all the time about running away to find her birth mother. She found out that Alexis had been featured in the music video for Soul Asylum's Runaway Train in 1993. Something I learned about this music video when doing the research for this episode is that there were different versions of it for different regions. So we're watching MTV and VH1 in Michigan. We're getting specific missing persons local to us, and Andrea Bowman was one of them. Kathy reached out to the local police department, and as it just so happened, the detective that she spoke with, Chris Haverdink, had gone to school with Alexis. He was a couple years older, but he remembered her, and he remembered how nobody really seemed to care when she disappeared, and that never sat right with him. So he was more than willing to give the case the attention it had always deserved but never gotten. And Kathy made one more really important connection. Through the Facebook group, she found Carl Koppelman. And once the two of them teamed up, the top armchair detective in the country and a mother willing to burn the world to the ground to find her missing child. Game over, dude. Game over. In 2013, 3 years after Kathy got that fateful letter and embarked on a mission to find her daughter, a few important things happened. A, The DNA results came back, confirming what Kathy had come to suspect, that Racine County Jane Doe was not Alexis. Authorities would eventually identify the body as that of 23-year-old Peggy Johnson from Illinois. She'd been murdered by a woman, a nurse, who'd hired her as a live-in housekeeper but kept her like a prisoner and tortured her for years before her death. Two, Kathy made her first trip to Michigan and met Carl Koppelman in person for the first time. And C, on May 11th, 2013, she got a message through the Find Andrea Bowman Facebook page from a young woman named Meta that rocked her world. Meta was from Holland, which, again, is the nearest big city to Hamilton, where Alexis was from. Meta took a special interest in local girls who had gone missing because when she was just 6 years old, she had survived a kidnapping. In September of 1989, just 6 months after Alexis disappeared, 6-year-old Meta was walking to a friend's house after school. As she passed the Windmill gas station in Holland, a man pulled up in a red pickup truck and approached her. He told her, "Your mom said I could take you to a barn to see some puppies." And then he picked her up, put her in his truck, and drove off. As he's passing all of these barns and starting to drive out of town, Meta realized she was in danger, even though the man was pretty nice at first. Eventually, he pulled over, took Meta out of the truck, and dragged her into the woods. He took off all of her clothes and tied her sweater around her mouth to keep her quiet. He tied her hands behind her back, and as he knelt over her, unzipping his pants, dogs began barking nearby. The man hastily ran off, assuming there must be people following the dogs, and Meta ran naked and barefoot back out to the main road, where passersby found her and called 911. Meta told the police what the man looked like, even worked with a sketch artist, gave a description of his truck, and told them that the man looked and smelled dirty, like he was a mechanic or a painter. Her case was never solved, but that didn't stop her from looking, even when the statute of limitations ran out 10 years later. She always thought that the key to finding the man who'd abducted her might lie in the cases of other missing girls. And she was right. She just didn't expect to find it in the form of a family photo on the Find Andrea Bowman Facebook page. Dennis Bowman, the missing girl's father, was her attacker. By the time Kathy received this shocking news from Meta, she'd already begun to suspect Dennis. She knew about the abuse Alexis's friend had witnessed, she knew about the sexual abuse allegations, and after filing a Freedom of Information Act request, she knew about Dennis's criminal background, the conviction in 1980 for attempting to kidnap and rape a teenage girl, and another conviction in 1998, many years later, for breaking and entering, which was a gross oversimplification of what happened. In 1998, so we're talking 9 years after Andrea has disappeared, 28-year-old Vicky Vandenbrink, a neighbor of the Bowmans, reported multiple break-ins at her mobile home, with always odd personal belongings going missing. The break-ins happened so frequently, police set up an alarm system at the house. One afternoon, the alarm went off, and when police responded to the Vandenbrink residence, guess who they found? Dennis freaking Bowman. He tried to tell them that he was a friend of Vicky's and had been staying with her, but they confirmed with Vicky that that was not true. Then he said he just came into the house to use the bathroom, and they were like, bruh, come on. Who breaks into a house to take a piss? Pee on a bush, right? So they searched Dennis's belongings and they found a black duffel bag with some of Vicky's lingerie inside it, as well as a black sweatshirt, a mask, and a sawed-off shotgun. So, breaking and entering doesn't sound right here. He was literally stalking this woman for months and absolutely had ill intent, but breaking and entering is the charge he pled guilty to. By 2016, after all she'd learned, Kathy Turkanian was positive that Dennis Bowman had killed her daughter. Further, She was sure that Alexis was buried in the Bowman's backyard. She maintained this theory even when people pointed out that that didn't make any sense. The Bowmans didn't live in that house when Alexis disappeared. Why would she be in that backyard? But Kathy was adamant that that was where she was. When she visited Michigan, she would stand across the street for hours just watching the backyard, so sure that she'd found her daughter. She also did some other pretty unorthodox things. She paid to have a billboard put up on the main road leading to the Bowman home, one that they would have to pass by to get literally anywhere, and the billboard offered an $11,000 reward for an arrest related to Alexis's disappearance, with these giant photos of Alexis on it. One was her last school photo, and then the other was an age progression photo. Kathy called the Bowmans multiple times a day, every day. They didn't pick up, obviously, so she would leave long, loud messages. And when the time ran out and the machine hung up, she would call right back and start again. "I know what you did. You killed my daughter. You monsters. I'm coming for you. You won't get away with this, you pieces of shit," etc. It got so bad, the Bowmans eventually disconnected their phone. But Kathy did not stop. She sent them letters. The Facebook page that she created still exists, by the way. It's called Justice for Andrea M. Bowman Now, and you can scroll back to the beginning. It's all still there. You can kind of watch its evolution from when it started way back in 2012, and she was just kind of putting out feelers like, "Hey, anybody out there know my daughter? Please reach out to me." To her getting more and more fired up the more she found out, to her going full scorched earth by 2016. Like, "I am coming for you bitches," all caps, no fucks given. And to everything that's happened since, she still posts regularly on the page today. On November 22nd, 2019, Kathy received a call from Meta, who she'd gotten very close with over the years, and Meta just said, "They got him." Meta, who, remember, was the little girl that had survived the kidnapping and found the page and identified Dennis as the guy, Meta still lived in the Hamilton, Holland area, and a friend of hers lived just down the road from the Bowmans. So when authorities descended upon the Bowman home in droves that morning, some 30 years after Alexis had disappeared, Meta was one of the first people to find out about it. And of course, she immediately called Kathy. All day long, Kathy waited for the news that Dennis had been arrested for murder. When the call came, it was not at all what she expected. Dennis had been arrested for murder, but not for killing his adopted daughter. He'd been arrested for a 1980 cold case out of Norfolk, Virginia, the murder of 25-year-old Kathleen Doyle. Kathleen was a Navy wife whose husband was deployed overseas, as well as an aspiring author, who was murdered in her home in September of 1980. She'd been bound and gagged, raped, stabbed, and strangled with electric wire. While DNA evidence was collected from the scene, DNA technology didn't really exist yet, and police had no leads. In 1983, that bobblehead chucklefuck Henry Lee Lucas confessed to the murder. But as was the case with most of the other murders he confessed to purely for clout, he was lying. Real quick, Michigan tie here. Lucas's first and possibly only real victim was his own mother, who he murdered in Tecumseh, Michigan in 1960. I hate to use the word victim, though, because she was a horrible woman and was 100% the reason her nasty son turned out the way that he did. So I guess we can just jot down another horrible Michigan mother while we're at it here. Anyway, after the Lucas confession turned out to be bogus, the murder of Kathleen Doyle went back into cold case status, where it sat until 2019, when a little technological development called ancestral DNA testing was employed. Instead of just using the DNA collected from the scene to look for Kathleen's killer, they were able to use it to look for anyone said killer might be related to, and then kind of triangulate and narrow it down. Listen, there are books about how this works. Being as bad at science as I am, cannot explain it to you, but it's really cool how they do this. So basically, instead of only being able to track down killers, they can now track down anybody you've ever been related to, right? So they did this. They tested seminal fluid collected from Kathleen's bedspread using ancestral DNA technology, and it gave them back a list of 31 names. One of the names on that list was Dennis Bowman. At the time of Kathleen Doyle's murder, the Bowmans were already living back in Michigan. Alexis was six. Dennis was, in fact, out on bond awaiting trial for the attack on that 19-year-old girl. But he was still in the Naval Reserves, and he was scheduled to do 2 weeks of training in Virginia. And they let him go while he was awaiting trial for attacking a young girl. For some fucking reason, authorities didn't have Dennis's DNA in the system to double dog check and just make super sureties that this is the guy they're looking for in this murder now. I don't understand this part. Like, they matched him through the ancestral DNA, but they didn't have his direct DNA. I don't know. Anyway, I cannot wait to tell you guys how they got his DNA, because this shit's so crazy. So this whole investigation into Kathleen Doyle's murder was happening behind the scenes while Kathy Jerkanian was going out of her way to make the Bowmans as miserable as she possibly could. The billboards, the letters, the Facebook page, the constant phone calls. Dennis and Brenda regularly called the police to complain. They wanted a restraining order or harassment charges, something. And the police now wanted Dennis's DNA. So they invited them to come down to the station and talk about it. And while they were there, they gave them each bottled water. And then they ever so discreetly kept Dennis's bottle so that they could test his DNA. So in a way, by trying to solve her daughter's disappearance, Kathy Jerkanian helped solve the murder of Kathleen Doyle. But this is two cases now, right? The Racine County Jane Doe, not Alexis, as originally suspected, but solved. Closure. And now Kathleen Doyle. Dennis is charged with a murder, but it's not Alexis, it's someone else. And for her family, closure. Where was Kathy's closure? She was fighting so hard, doing all of the things we all think and say we would do if something happened to our child. And Kathy was doing those things and more, but Alexis was still missing. Well, Dennis was due to be extradited to Virginia to be tried for Kathleen Doyle's murder. Not only was Virginia still a death penalty state at the time, but it was an awful long way from Dennis's beloved wife and daughter. They had his DNA, they had his recorded confession. He was not getting out of this. But if he would tell them what happened to Alexis, if he would lead them to her body, they could keep him in Michigan. Probably. So Dennis came clean. Kinda. He told police that on the day Alexis disappeared, they got into a fight and he hit her so hard that she fell backwards down the stairs and broke her neck. He stashed her body in the barn while he called police to file a larceny complaint against her. While Brenda was allegedly out searching the streets all night for Alexis, Dennis was dismembering her body so that he could fit it into a small barrel and bury it. About Alexis's body. Even after admitting to murdering her, Dennis would not tell police where to find her body. He told several different stories to authorities and to Brenda before finally revealing the truth. And I feel like he did that as kind of like his final power move, right? The last thing that he had. Or it could have just been because after everything, he didn't want to have to admit that Kathy was right the entire time. In February of 2020, Alexis's body was found buried in the backyard of the home that the Bowmans moved to after Alexis disappeared, beneath a concrete slab, the exact place that Kathy told authorities they would find it. Dennis explained to Brenda in a recorded call that he had initially buried Alexis on the property where she died, where they lived, but then when they purchased the property that they put their manufactured home on, he dug her up and moved her before they ever even moved in. Alexis's dismembered remains were located in several different bags inside a barrel that also had dirty diapers and other trash in it. Dennis was extradited to Virginia to face charges for Kathleen Doyle's murder. He pleaded guilty and he was sentenced to 2 life sentences plus 20 years before being returned to Michigan to face charges in Alexis's murder. In 2022, he pleaded no contest to second-degree murder and he was sentenced to another 35 to 50 years for killing Alexis. Dennis Bowman, who was 73 years old at this time, expected to spend what time he had left in a Michigan prison, close to his wife and adult daughter, who continued to stand by him. So, color him surprised when authorities informed him that he was actually being sent back to Virginia instead to serve out his sentence there. He was extradited soon after, and he will spend the rest of his natural, shitty life in a Virginia prison. Now, here's something fucked up. Even after all of this, Alexis's remains were released to Brenda Bowman, legally her mother, and Brenda had her cremated. She has since given half of the remains to Kathy Turkanian, but Kathy's current mission is to A, get the rest of her daughter's remains. She doesn't like the idea of her being split in half or of Brenda having any access to any part of her daughter. She also wants Dennis Bowman removed from Alexis's birth certificate, and she wants Alexis's birth name restored so that she will officially be Alexis Miranda Badger. Now, it's been at least 9 hours here since the show started, so you might not even remember that I said at the beginning that this episode is about Michigan mothers who did unthinkable things to their daughters. And Dennis, aside from being a motherfucker, is no mother. But Brenda Bowman, who still lives in Michigan about an hour and a half away from me and was somewhat recently spotted working as a cashier at a Walgreens? Fuck that bitch. If you haven't watched the Netflix doc on this case yet, you have to go watch it. You've got that free trial already, or that 7-day trial or whatever, because you're watching Unknown Caller. You got to watch Girl in the Picture. You got to watch the new season of Bridgerton. So go watch this if you haven't seen it. You have to hear her in her own words talking about Alexis, talking to her husband about the things that he's done and how callous she is about her husband murdering women, murdering their daughter. It's insane. She's insane. Do I believe that she was an active participant in Alexis's murder, or that she knew with certainty that her adopted daughter was buried in her backyard the entire fucking time? No, I don't think that she, like, knew as a fact, but she knew. She fucking knew. And sorry, I'm chronically online. If you don't get that reference, I'm sorry. I do think that she knew with certainty, though, that Dennis was abusing Alexis, both sexually and non-sexually. And I do think, based on the things that Kathy found out from people who knew Alexis, that Brenda was an active participant in abusing, starving, and isolating Alexis. While Dennis Bowman has only been convicted of 2 murders, he's a serial killer. He has to be. Look at the shit that he has done. I think we all know that. And I think that fucking Brenda, his high school sweetheart, knew it before anybody else. And she stood by him anyway. Into the Fire, The Lost Daughter, was directed by not Sky Borgman this time, but Ryan White, and it was released on Netflix in 2024. Sandra Brandenburg of Livonia either sold her 6-year-old daughter to a man she barely knew, or failed to look for her, or even tell anyone, when he kidnapped her. As a result, her daughter lived a life of unspeakable horror and was murdered at the age of 20. The Netflix documentary, Girl in the Picture, tells her story. Kendra Lacari of Beale City spent months cyberbullying and stalking her own teenage daughter, even going so far as trying to drive her to suicide in what is believed to be a case of Munchausen by internet. As a result, her daughter suffered unimaginable trauma and lost some of the most precious years of her life. The Netflix documentary Unknown Caller tells her story. Brenda Bowman of Hamilton allowed her own husband to physically and sexually abuse their adopted daughter for years, enabling him and standing by him no matter what evil deeds he committed. As a result, her daughter was murdered and thrown out like trash at the age of 14. The Netflix documentary Into the Fire tells her story. Three viral Netflix documentaries showcasing the worst of humanity. Three deplorable women who never deserved to call themselves mothers, all still walking among us right here in Michigan. Well, maybe not Sandra Brandenburg. She looked like she was in pretty rough shape during the filming of Girl in the Picture, and that one came out a few years ago, so she might not be here anymore. I'm not sure. But those of you who stay up to date on true crime probably know all too well what the next chapter in this tragic series will be. The 2025 murder of Rebecca Park at the hands of her birth mother isn't a story you're likely to see me cover on the podcast, but I'm sure that Netflix is already all over it. That's it for me today. My main sources for today's episode were the Into the Fire documentary, obviously, but also this really good article that I found in Atavist magazine by Niall Capello about Andrea Bowman, nay Alexis Badger. And ironically, the article was called The Girl in the Picture, which is the name of the documentary about Suzanne Savakis. For even more Great Lakes true crime, be sure to check out this week's episode of Already Gone, wherever you get your podcasts. To keep up with all things Michigan Monsters, you can find me on Facebook and Instagram under Michigan Monsters Podcast, on TikTok under It's Jen Carpenter, and online at MichiganMonstersPodcast.com. I'm Jen Carpenter, and I will see you next time. Until then, remember to keep your doors locked, because not all monsters hide in the dark.